Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime. Why would I spend the rest of this week so bitter? And all that listening is making you bitter too. When I can go therapy, when I can go therapy, when I can go therapy 2 times a day. So hello and welcome to Radio Gorgeous. My name's Josephine Pembroke.
And I'm Donna Freed.
This is Gorgeous Gossip. And have you heard the news, Donna? Half of married men admit they find their mother-in-law attractive, and one in six says she's better looking than her wife. Two-thirds of men say they would be happy if their wife aged like their mother. A survey of 1,500 Britons revealed one in four husbands flirt with their partner's mum. And a cheeky 31% believe their wife's mother is attracted to them. Your mother is, I'm just thinking of your relationship with your husband and your mother. Did they know each other?
They did know each other. I mean, my mother's dead. I do remember in high school, my boyfriend, that my mother was flirting with my boyfriend when we went out to dinner one time. But I actually think it's a good ploy on a husband's part to flirt with, you know, the mother-in-law.
The dreaded mother-in-law.
Exactly.
Yeah, have a good relationship.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It smooths the waters.
My husband, when he first met my mum, the first 2 years, it was like a love affair. I mean, I wasn't jealous, but they were just, you know, mum and dad adored James. And
no
then,
way.
And now they have disdain for James, you know. And he went through that they adored him when they first met him, and now they find him a bit demanding.
I think my parents always liked my husband, but I can't imagine my husband fancied my mother.
No, and let me think of my husband. No, he said, because obviously I've asked him what he thinks of my mum. I mean, he does say she is very attractive for her age, you know. But my mother was not. Okay. You do say that you know somebody who you think there is a relevance here.
Oh, yeah, I definitely, I have a friend who his wife is very pretty, but the mother, you know, works in the same industry as him. And she has aged, you know, well, she hasn't aged, and drunk at their wedding. I did comment on this. I was like, oh, Mike must be so happy. He sees what he's getting in the future. I think she took it as a compliment, but I wasn't really noticing.
Who did you say it to?
The mother.
To the mother. I think the mother would love it. I don't think the bride would. Yeah. Does he flirt with her?
Who knows? I guess it must be in there. Oh, well, and I suspect the mother thinks that he's attracted to her. I suspect that's all true about that relationship.
I do know someone who, he was a friend of mine, and he went out with a friend, my friend, and then he did have sex with the mother. Yeah. that could be called Yorkshire in the 70s.
Oh, my God.
Remember, he seduced her in the bathroom one time.
Oh, my God. I'm shocked.
Good. I want to shock you. Right. What? Now, we're going to turn the tables round, and we're going to find out, would you... your father-in-law isn't alive.
They're all
bloody dead, you're not.
We're killing them off.
Yeah. Did you meet him, and was there a flick of flirtation or fancying? And can you tell us what he was like?
I find my husband very, very handsome, very dapper. And his father was very, very handsome. I would say his father was, you know, factually more handsome than my husband. I don't know that I'd say I like an older man, so I probably did flirt with him anyway. But also in the way that, you know, you flatter your father-in-law,
yeah,
you know. I mean,
yeah.
I think I'm supposed to, aren't
yeah,
I?
You yeah, know. Yeah.
You know, that's a non-threatening flirt.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll never forget the first time I ever met my husband's father. Lives in Swanage, and he's deeply eccentric. He walks around the town. In fact, he's lost it, but he used to walk around with a top hat and a traffic cone advertising for people. So he'd go, market day on Thursday in Wareham. And I remember just being in, first time I ever met him, I was in a supermarket, and he walked in and shouted that. I was like, oh, my God. And we were staying at his house, his kind of cottage in Dorset. And I remember I was wearing suspenders because it was early on in our relationship. I was just bending over, and he walked in. It was like, oh, my God. So we can have really had a laugh about that. But also he's got a more, because he's sort of, he's 80 now, but ever since I've met him, he's been retired. He's had a much lighter look on life than my husband. He can have more of a laugh. Mm-hmm. So actually, I have a real giggle with my husband's father. Mm-hmm. And I met him the other day because he collects Kissy Moo and takes her down to the dog hotel. That's my dog. And he said to me at the end of it, we spent half an hour. I gave him, I buy him a coffee, I buy him a banana, and I buy him a Daily Telegraph. He's so happy. And at the end of it, he said, Josephine, you really are good company. Aww. And that was such a compliment, yes. You know. I do find my husband's age group, who are about 3 years younger than me, they never flirt with me.
No, they find it very threatening. You know, like they only flirt if they mean it.
Yeah, which is so boring. I mean, I think the world goes round so much better if you have a little flirt, and especially with your father-in-law. RadioGorgeous.com. Now, let's go to this week's guest, which is Sharon Dunscombe, which is another fascinating interviewee, which I met on Twitter. And you know what she does? She's a bibliotherapist.
Bibliotherapist.
Well, she's going to explain exactly what that is, Donna, because you don't know either, do you?
Nope.
Here's Sharon.
When I can go therapy, when I can go therapy, when I can go therapy two times a day.
I'm here with Sharon Dunscombe, and I'm asking, what is a bibliotherapist? Because she set up her own business, and she is one, and it's called Tales for Tea. So, Sharon, hi, and welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, it's lovely to be here.
Now, you've got to explain to us what bibliotherapy is. I mean, biblio reminds me, the word reminds me of Bibles and libraries.
Yes, so. And a lot of people do sort of look in complete horror and say, oh, my God, you're going to start reading the Bible.
You're born again.
To be honest, it's probably a good idea, because the Bible is obviously full of very good stories. Bibliotherapy, it's been around since 300 BC, the word, the Greeks. Used bibliotherapy. Aristotle used the word bibliotherapy as healing for the soul, as a name over all of the libraries. So I haven't invented the word. There aren't many of me around, though. The bibliotherapy tends to normally mean prescribing self-help books, and that is exactly what I do not do, because I think if people are suffering with mental health, the last thing I think they would want is a self-help book. So what I do is I go to a vast collection of short stories and poems. I present those stories to a group, and I read the story, and I use the story and the characters as a vessel to allow people to identify with what is going on in the story, and allows them to talk about their own problems under the sort of invisible cloak of a character or a story. I found that it takes away the stigma of going along to a therapist. Bibliotherapy uses the story and the characters to build the empathy in the group, to share experiences. It's a very compassionate therapy, and it's a very safe therapy without having to be labelled or stigmatised. So it takes a lot of fear away. So bibliotherapy is healing with books.
So can you describe what happened in Kensington, Chelsea last week? So you go along. Hi, I'm Sharon. What do you do?
Yeah, well, I go along. I take along a short story. It's normally 4 or 5 A4 pages in length.
So not too long.
But that 4 or 5 A4 pages takes an hour and a half to read.
Wow.
Yes. So a real, real lot of discussion goes into what is coming out of the text. Everybody has a copy of the story, and I basically start reading 3 or 4 paragraphs, and then I will stop, and I will just say, right, let's go back over what I've just read and think about what is going on in the story. How do we think the character is feeling? Where do you think they are? Can anybody identify with how the character might be feeling? And, you know, for the first 10 minutes, everyone's sort of staring at each other, saying nothing. And then one person will say, well, actually, I think they might be feeling this. There's a lot of, you know, my friend, I've got a friend that felt like this. That's fine. If they don't want to talk about it that freely at the beginning, that's fine. But what I find is that once somebody has opened up, I will then facilitate that. So I will then talk to the person, right, David, that's really interesting.
And that's in front of everybody.
In front of everybody. Okay. So the groups are only maximum 10 people, so it's quite an intimate space. And within half an hour, you can feel the empathy in the room. And rather than just a bunch of strangers sitting there, they're all beginning to invisibly identify with each other. And it might not be exactly the same problem that they're experiencing, but the empathy builds, the room becomes very safe, stigmas are left outside the door, and it just promotes a lot of compassionate healing discussion. And once the healing starts, you know, we have a lot of tears, we have a lot of laughter, we actually have a lot of friendships that are formed within the groups. I will then also read a story at the end. I always bring it together with a poem, sorry, not a story, with a poem, because the poems will relate to the story that I've read, but they're very noun-rich. They build up very rich, undiluted images of the story that I've read. So it sort of seals the story into their minds.
What, so is it, have you written, do you write the poem? Who's written the poem?
No, I don't write the poem. I go through a lot of, for every weekly session I run, it takes me probably 2 days to match the material.
Wow.
The more I do it, the more I've obviously, I can link them together.
What, you know, short stories and what authors you use, because obviously Radio Gorgeous is so into authors.
Absolutely. I mean, I use anything and everything. I use the classics, I use good old Charles Dickens, I use a lot of Carol Ann Duffy, I use a lot of Anne Tyler. I will never read anything that I am not passionate about myself, because I can't expect people to be talking to me about their feelings if I have no feeling for the text. So I research it very, very carefully, and I use anything and everything.
Radio Gorgeous, giving you a voice. Why not leave us a voice message? Over to you now.
So back in Devon, I'm working with a company called Madewell, who is a community group for people with poor mental health. We're reading Wind in the Willows.
Lovely.
We all decided last week, which was a magical moment, that Mr. Toad is bipolar. I thought that was an incredible revelation to come out of such a fantastic book. And there is no right and there is no wrong if that member thinks that Mr. Toad is bipolar, because he's reacting the way she does to a lot of situations. I've done my job.
It sounds marvellous. Now, are they wanting to read more?
They are wanting to read more. We have a lot of people that start off quite nervous, and then over the
weeks, they think, I'm not literary, I'm not wordy. Yeah. I've only ever read a magazine.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Mm. Mm. The lovely thing with what I do is there is no need for any critical knowledge to the text. It is not an English Appreciation Society.
So it's not a book club.
It's not a book club. It's most definitely not a book club. The number of people that have said to me that the last time they felt the way I make them feel is when they were young and their parents were reading to them as a child. I do not understand why we think that reading to people has to stop when we get to a certain age.
So I'm dying to know, how did you get into bibliotherapy?
I started practicing bibliotherapy about 10 years ago when my daughter was 5. I was a teaching assistant in her class, and I used to run a little book club after school, waiting for the mums and dads to come and pick them up. And I noticed that the reaction to the stories I was reading was much more vivid than an adult would be. But the children were actually beginning to relate what I was reading to their own lives. And I just sort of saw an interesting connection and started researching bibliotherapy.
And does it exist? I mean, are you the only one doing it?
I don't think I can possibly be the only one doing it. There are a couple of other organisations that do shared reading.
Now, how passionate are you about books, and how did you become a book person?
I'm hugely passionate about books. I have been reading ever since I can ever remember. My grandfather loved books. I was a real sit on my granddad's knee and go through all the books. Brer Rabbit was my favourite. Encyclopedias, anything. As long as I was sitting on my granddad's lap, I would read it. I read very, very avidly. I studied for a degree in English literature, which I loved. And yeah, I've just always been surrounded by books. I will never, ever stop loving what I do.
It's amazing. Now, because we're an all-women's radio station, I have to ask, what's your famous female author and why?
Do you know what? It's quite, it sounds quite twee. My favourite female author is a lady called Miss Reed. She's very famous for Thrush Green. I had a very bad breakdown myself when my daughter started school, suffered with severe separation anxiety, and didn't talk to anybody about it for a year because I was terrified that my daughter would be taken away from me. I didn't tell anybody, including my husband. Miss Reed, I'd read a lot when I was a young teenager, and I wrote to her. She died recently, about 4 years ago, but she wrote back to me. And she wrote me a wonderful, wonderful letter saying, these times will come to an end. You will seek help and you will get better. And because of her, I was on a road to recovery. Because of her, I think it's a lot of reason why I became a bibliotherapist.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, I just want to talk about the separation anxiety. To be honest, I've never heard of that, someone had separation anxiety from their child.
It was very, very frightening. Yeah, it was very frightening. It's my husband, my daughter and I. There's only the three of us. Very, very close. Love each other to pieces. Very, very close-knit. And I worship her still to this day. But, you know, at that stage, it was a huge wrench that I had to take her to school.
And how far away was the school?
Oh, do you really want me to be honest? Quarter of a mile.
Wow.
Yeah, but I suffered terribly.
Yeah, can you tell me what happened to you?
I just became very, very depressed. Very, very depressed. I couldn't stop crying. And yeah, I was in a very, very dark place.
And you never told your husband?
I didn't tell my husband for a year. I was a teaching assistant at the time at her school.
Was that so you could be near her?
Yes, that was so I could be near her, absolutely. But I obviously only worked 2 days a week, so the rest of the time she was there without me. Invited to tea parties, birthday parties. You know, the first time she went on summer camp at whatever age it was, 7 or 8, and I had a complete nervous breakdown. It was highly, highly terrifying. But I was very frightened that I was going to pop that bubble of a perfect life, that he would see me as not the person he thought I was. And I was obviously terrified that she would be taken away. In the end, when my hair was literally on fire every minute of the day, I thought, you know, my life can't get any worse. So if they're going to take me away and lock me up, it can't be worse than what I'm going through. So I went to the doctors and they were fantastic. And they said, we'll get you better. Simple as that.
Oh, but that was one of the best moments of your life.
Do you know
life.
What? Yeah. It was. You know, some medication you have to be very careful with. They taught me through it very, very carefully. I was on medication for 6 months. I was under psychiatric care for a year. And I can remember taking the first tablet of diazepam and I just said to my husband, my hair isn't on fire anymore. I know I'm going to be all right.
Oh.
So there we are.
So I'm very interested to know, thank you so much for sharing that with me. Do you think because of your experience you can just help people more? I mean, tell me about it.
100% yes. I have no problem talking to people about mental health issues. I have suffered it from the very core of my being, so I know exactly what it's like to be there. Everybody's going to suffer from poor mental health at one stage or another. Not one in four, every single person. But I know now that you can be given the tools to be made better.
Sharon, it has been moving, amazing, and I'm just so pleased that you come onto Radio Gorgeous and talk to us about this. So if people want to contact you, how do they contact you?
Right, well, they can contact me through my webpage, which is www.talesfortea.co.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tales for Tea, or just Google Tales for Tea and I'm there. I'm passionate about what I do. And yeah, I'm going to get bibliotherapy out there and I'm going to make it work.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio
Thank
Gorgeous.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Why would I spend the rest of my
day so bitter? And thanks so much, Sharon, for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. And thank you so much, Donna. Thank you so much, Ella Gray Thomas, for editing. This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2015. Follow us on Twitter. Over 2,923 people, can't be wrong.